language documentation and documentary linguistics have discussed different aspects of linguistic fieldwork. For example, Samarin, 1967, Kubrick, 1997, Wu and Cooper, 1999, Newman and Ratliff, 2001, Bauer, 2008, to name a few. One of the major concerns in language documentation is discussing and theorizing about all the relevant considerations. This includes both practical and theoretical work, which may involve considerable preparation in some cases, but also on-the-spot decision-making in others. In order to inform you about the limitations and the kind of theorizing involved, I will discuss some of the most important issues and challenges that I faced in documenting Burushaski. These challenges range from initial encounters in persuading the community to participate, social and cultural obstructions in data collection, ethical issues in the effective use of information technologies, in meeting the project goals without disrupting community traditions and cultural practices, and issues related to language revitalization. I know it's a lot to talk about, but I will only talk about some of the major issues that I met with. I cannot talk about all these issues in detail, so I have picked a few things that I really thought were important. My approach proposes an integrated framework which relies on a comprehensive series of various steps involved in collecting and recording linguistic materials for documentation and preservation, as well as proposals for revitalization. Here's the region that my work is focused on. This is the map of Jammu and Kashmir, including regions controlled by India, Pakistan, and China. And I'm sure most of you know that this is a disputed territory. And it's been a conflict zone for more than six decades between India and Pakistan, mainly. Here's another map. That's the Gilgit region. Okay, let me show you where there's Srinagar, where I worked mainly. That's my birth town. And the northern areas of Pakistan, where Gilgit is located, which is where a majority of the Burushaski speakers are located, live. Here is a closer view, another map showing Pakistan with Gilgit district in the northern areas region. Burushaski is a linguistic isolate. There's been a lot of debate about its genetic affiliations, but no convincing arguments have been made about its genetic links. Many people have argued that this is probably an Indo-European language coming from language such as, I mean, related to maybe Frisian or Thracian or something like that, but we don't have convincing evidence to support those claims. The regional dialects, there are four regional dialects, actually three main regional dialects spoken in Hunza, Nagar, and Yasin valleys. Yasin dialect is also called Virchigwar because it's very different from the other dialects. And then there are some speakers in Srinagar, which is in India. And the total estimated total number of speakers is around 90,000 or maybe more or maybe less, I don't know, according to Ethnologue 2005, and around 300 in India in Srinagar. Some of the major contact languages are Urdu, which is the official language of Pakistan and the state official language of the Jammu and Kashmir state in India. Shina, another Indo-Aryan so-called Dardic language. Wakhi and Khwar, and Kashmiri is also Dardic, and then Balti, which is a Tibeto-Burman language. And there's a linguistic map of the region, if you can see that. Where's the mouse? Here's Burushaski. Here's where I worked. There are some speakers here. Okay, here's a closer map of Gilgit district, and there's Yasin, Hunza, and Nagar. They are geographically located in different areas, so the dialects are different. Yasin dialect is very different from the other two dialects. The question is Burushaski endangered? Is it an endangered language? As a general rule, there are two most common reasons for language endangerment. Scenario one, where there are few living native speakers of particular languages, and the second scenario, where many children do not learn the language of their parents because other languages are considered to be more important or helpful or powerful. Like many minority and endangered languages of South Asia, Burushaski is fighting against both of these scenarios of language endangerment. And a number of sociolinguistic factors contribute towards the endangerment of Burushaski. These include the following. The language is primarily orally preserved, and literacy in the native language is almost zero. Most Burushaski speakers are bilingual in their native language and at least one of the regional languages. There are also speakers who are trilingual, multilingual, like many speakers speak, many people speak Burushaski, Shina, Balti, Kashmiri, to name a few, and Urdu and English. So there are many different types of multilinguals. The language has been greatly influenced not only by a number of dominant regional languages such as Urdu, Khowar, Shina, Wakhi, Balti, and Kashmiri, but has also been considerably influenced by foreign languages such as Persian, Arabic, and also English recently. With greater means of mobility and travel opportunities, more and more Burushas have chosen to move to bigger cities for education and job opportunities. Therefore, imperfect knowledge of the language is very common, and fluency in Burushaski among the second and third generation is on a rapid decline. Increasing exogamy is posing additional threat to the survival of the language. Many Burushas in Pakistan, especially in the in Gilgit region, in Hunza and Nagar valleys, they have started marrying outside to Khowar-speaking people, Shina-speaking people, and same thing with the Srinagar. In Srinagar, people there among you have around 300 speakers, 300 Burushas, and it's hard to find people, you know, 300 people. So they have started marrying with Kashmiri and other communities, ethnic communities. Okay. Attitude towards Burushaski among native speakers is that of less prestigious language, especially in comparison with Urdu. Just like speakers of other minority and less powerful languages in the region, dominance and hegemony of Urdu has resulted in a strong push for a majority of Burushas to shift to Urdu as the main language of their communication. Despite documentation efforts by some Western scholars in the past, such as Berger, 1974, Hermann Berger, to 1988, and Lorimer, initially, in 1935, around that period, and others, also many others, the community has been unable to avail of the materials. Most, if not all of them, are in foreign languages, such as German and French, which the speakers are not, which the Burushas are not literate in. Recently, some local scholars, especially in Pakistan, have initiated some efforts towards the language revitalization. However, these are yet to produce concrete results because of various factors. For example, lack of trained linguists, funding issues, lack of institutional and government support. I don't know if you're aware of language policies in that region. Language policies in that region, a language can be given an official status only if it has a written literature, if it has a writing system, written literature, going back to a long period of time. So according to those standards, Burushaski does not meet those standards. So that's one more problem to get institutional support. Okay. My documentation work on Burushaski began in 2003, about a year after I had discovered that a few hundred speakers of the language lived in my hometown. Many people don't even know there are Burushaski speakers in Kashmir, and many of them didn't know what the language was that they spoke, what was the name of the language that they spoke. So it was kind of a discovery for me to know that they lived in Kashmir. And many people don't treat them as if they are natives and think that they are some of Kashmiri, or people treat them as Tibeto Burmans. Many people call them, Kashmiri people call them Bhattaraj. Bhatta is a term usually used for Tibetans and Mongoloid people. So that's an erroneous use of the term. Okay, so the study began, my study on Burushaski began in 2003 in Srinagar. The study provides a structural description of this previously undocumented variety of Burushaski and analyzes the various forms of linguistic interference and language change in this dialect, which had separated from the mainstream Burushaski in Pakistan in about 1890. Here is the field site where I worked, started working. And that is, this is a part of Srinagar city. And the little hill that you can see, I don't know if you can see this, this is the hill. And this is a fort called Hari Parbat Fort. This is where, by the Hari Parbat Fort, where the Srinagar Burushas live. Over the past 5 years and a half, okay, there are some more pictures of the field site. So that's the hill, and so I had to go around the hill and drive around. It's a very tough drive, and then go inside. And there's an inside picture. This is a closer picture. This is the road, this little, this road here. It's like this. And I was really, it was very difficult to drive on that. Anyway. So over the past 5.5 years, I collected a corpus of Burushaski data in Srinagar, which includes digital audio and video recordings of narratives and stories, historical legends, natural conversations, oratory, a number of poems collected over a period of 13 months during 5 field trips. A significant portion of the data has been transcribed, translated, and analyzed with the help of native speakers. I have also collected data from and worked with speakers of some Pakistani Burusho settled in the U.S. In the second phase of my project, I proposed to create a cross-dialectal, linguistically analyzed and searchable digital archive of annotated Burushaski text. The project outcomes for this will be a corpus of audio and video materials with time-aligned transcription, multi-tier annotations, and morpheme-to-morpheme translations into English at one level. But there will also be a collection of texts, for example, which will include historical legends, popular stories, narratives, and poems, with free translations into Urdu and English. This is my research team. This is Mr. P.R. Karim, my co-author. He's an ESL teacher, a linguistic scholar, and an ESL teacher at the Aga Khan University in Pakistan, Karachi, and Dr. Shahnaz Hunzai, who is the director of an ongoing Burushaski Urdu dictionary project in Karachi, Pakistan, called a non-government, locally run organization by these people called Burushaski Research Academy. Now, next, I would talk about the issues. Starting with initial encounters, these are the major issues I'm going to talk about: data collection and data access, gender and social norms, ethical issues, and issues in archiving, dissemination, and revitalization. Initial encounters in persuading a speech community to participate in a documentation project may be varied and at times exhausting. Mine were a mixture of both pleasant and unpleasant episodes. The region, including Kashmir and its adjoining areas in Pakistan and Afghanistan, has experienced continued political turmoil for decades, as I said earlier. America is not particularly seen as a good friend of Muslims in that part of the world. Despite the fact that I was originally from the region and a Muslim, a number of people perceived my project with a certain degree of suspicion. Questions would arise as to why would Americans fund a project on a language spoken in Kashmir? For over a century after their migration in Srinagar, the Burushas in Srinagar have been an invisible minority. After all, what would a linguistic scholar based in the U.S. gain by learning a language which does not have any commercial value? Or who would want to learn Burushaski in the U.S.? Why is she learning this language? Why is she working on this language? Those were the questions that I faced. And also another one, being able to speak Burushaski was like having access to a secret world or a treasure where others, including Kashmiris, would not be able to enter. And they love this feeling that we can speak a language which nobody understands. So they don't want others to learn it. There were occasions where I was categorically told by, especially by younger people, you just leave, we don't want you to work on this language. And the second issue concerned the selection of native speaker consultants. That was the initial encounters. Selection of native speaker consultants. Regarding this issue, Wu and Cooper suggest that naive informants are better to work with because there are less chances of getting misleading information. Similarly, Abbey 2001, quoted in Bowern 2008, maintains that school teachers are good contacts but not necessarily good initial contacts because of tendencies to prescription. The most ideal native speaker consultant, according to Bauer in 2000. When did I start? I don't think I can talk about everything. So, is one who is very fluent in the native language and excellent second language speaker of contact languages. A fluent storyteller, has a clear articulation with no speech impediments, and has an infinite amount of patience. Not all of these criteria could be met when you are working with a community of 300 speakers where most adults work full-time and youngsters go to school. The first speaker who agreed to participate on my project was a retired school teacher with a very unclear voice and a tendency to prescribe. His extraordinary interest in the project helped in identifying some of the most proficient male speakers of the language. But he also became one of the primary hurdles in involving and engaging women and some other speakers in the project. Conscious of his literary knowledge, he was proficient in Urdu, Persian, Kashmiri, and also fairly proficient in English. He exhibited a domineering tendency. And oftentimes like to prescribe his own ideas rather than follow what I would like. And initially, I was working on language contact and contact-induced language change. So I wanted to work with everybody, with through generations, males, females, younger people, children, and so on. But he insisted I work only with older people and only with males because women don't speak well enough. The other thing, he helped me identify some of the other older males. They were very fluent in the language. So these are some of the other speakers. I will not talk about conflicts of interest. Conflicts of interest included, they wanted me to work on write their history, mention their history. Their history is very interesting. They came from a royal family. Their forefather was a king in Gilgit Agency. And they were arrested in 1890 by a combined force of British and Dogra troops and brought to Srinagar and put under arrest in this very fort that I showed you earlier. And so they're more fascinated by their history than they're not so interested in language change and language documentation. And there were other issues. I'm not going to talk about those right now because we don't have enough time. Okay. And then data collection, selection and restrictions. Okay, can I take 5 minutes from the question session? Because I don't think I can finish. The questions regarding data collection and selection, what type and of data need to be recorded? The notion of natural data and context. What kind and number of speech samples or events are relevant for inclusion on the documentation? According to Himmelman, 1998, as many as varied and as natural or spontaneous data samples as possible. Well, there was a problem with the natural data. The natural data are not maybe sometimes too natural to be included on the project. And there were also other issues regarding consent, informed consent. And also, when you are working with a very small community, and most of them were, it's not an aboriginal community. Most of the people are educated. They work full-time jobs, and it was difficult to find people. So anyway, I tried to get as much as I could and whatever was available to me. The third question relating data selection was whether the data were fairly representative of the different dialects. I've mainly worked in Srinagar, and some people, when I applied for funding, argued that this dialect is not representative of the majority community, so why don't you work in Pakistan? Well, it's not easy to travel to Pakistan. I've tried every year to go to Pakistan, but I've not been able to get a visa or funding, so there have been various issues with that. So the backup plan for me was to work with native speakers of Pakistani Burushos in the U.S. and bring native speakers from Pakistan for training here. Okay, the next issue that I want to talk about is gender and social norms. Researcher, whether the researcher is an intruder or an insider or an outsider. I was neither an insider nor an outsider. So different issues, I faced with different issues. The first thing was the dress code and observing parda, the headscarf. That was an ideological question for me because I'm from the same city and previously had made a choice not to. So I put myself in a situation of being ridiculed upon. Okay, that was the dress code. You can see how I dress there. The second one was crossing the gender barrier. In many documentation studies, we talk about crossing the gender barrier. Despite some of the very many positive side effects of my gender, I was able to access female speakers, but which a Western male researcher may not have been able to do. There were also, being a young female was one of the most problematic areas. Few men could be persuaded to enter a room where I was sitting. Further, it's almost near impossible to imagine a Kashmiri Muslim woman carrying an audiovisual device and equipment recording men or women for that matter. So that was another problem. There were also other gender-motivated obstructions to data collection. For example, any activity which may expose women to strangers is not permitted. So I could not video record, I could not take pictures and so on. Women should not be included in the project because they cannot speak their native language as well as men. So that was another problem. It took me about more than a year or two to include, to persuade speakers and to persuade women to participate and persuade these young, older males because they were very dominant in what I do, domineering. They would direct who I can talk to, who I cannot talk to, who will be the best speakers and so on. So it took me quite some time to deal with this issue. So I could not have dealt with this situation until I made friends with the daughters of this school teacher. This is his one of his daughters, Hasina. And there are some more, one of his daughters, Azra, and then some of the neighboring women. So I included women in the projects, educated women mainly, who did data collection for me. And then through them, I involved some younger men to do data collection for me in my absence. So these are some of the women speakers who work with me. This is one of the younger males, Raja Shujat Ali Khan. And the next issue was the informed consent, the main problem. There were many issues with informed consent. I will talk about this briefly. First one was the format of the informed consent. Should the informed consent be oral or written? In a conflict zone such as Kashmir, people are highly skeptical of giving written consent. Therefore, oral consent was the alternative. But the problem with oral consent was that people would not agree to, people may not consent to what you think that they consented for later. So, okay. And they may disagree later. That happened with me. Oh, this is not what I wanted. This is not. They gave me consent initially, and then later, when they listen to that, they'll say, "Oh no, we'll do that again. This is not good. This is not what I want," and so on. There are so many recordings that I had to. They said you cannot include them later. And there were also the problem of the paradox of the paradox, the natural data. The natural data were too natural sometimes to be included, especially in case of women. So in case of women, there was a moral question in front of me whether I could or could not include some of the recordings that I had made with respect to women, yeah, especially younger women. When they did agree, they gave me informed consent, but the problem was that if I did include those in my documentation, they might upset the cultural tradition. When they're older, when they're adult males, will see those women without parda, that might have a consequence in the cultural, in terms of the cultural tradition. So that was the paradox of the paradox. Another thing was: does seeking informed consent give the researcher the right to access to the data sought for? So, for example, I wanted to record a wedding ceremony, and I had all the consent, everything from the community, from the family who was hosting this marriage ceremony. I also had informed consent from the elders of the community. But one single old woman objected. She said, "You cannot record this wedding." And she was not even the host. She was a guest. And she just objected. And then I had to just take this picture, which is in front of you. That's the only thing I could record from that wedding, just that tent where there's nobody sitting there. Finally, the archiving and dissemination questions. Is digital archiving an efficient way of disseminating the materials to the community where few members are computer literate and access to internet is highly restricted? So I propose to do both print and internet methods, use both of them. For effective dissemination of materials, which language is appropriate for translation? So, for example, an English or German translation of Burshavsky documentation materials may not be as useful or as widely understood by the language community or as an Urdu translation. So I propose to do that. This is how I will do this. There's a sample from a story, Shiri Badat, an excerpt in Burshavsky text is at the top, and then in Urdu translation, then and down you have the English transcription and main translation. And then finally, that I'm concluding now. Should the documentation project include a proposal for language revitalization? Will revitalization efforts be meaningful without direct involvement of the community? What method should be adopted in revitalization efforts in order to be efficient? Which script will be? Script is the major issue. Appropriate for writing a language such as Burshavsky. Any language documentation effort, I think, is incomplete and useless for the community if it does not include proposals for revitalization, especially if the language has still a chance to survive. And there are still a substantial number of speakers left. Okay, so my proposal for that is the direct involvement of the community. The future goals, concluding, towards Burshavsky revitalization is to develop an efficient, effective method of language learning with the help of the research team and local native speakers, scholars, who will include people working at Burshavsky Research Academy in Pakistan and also native speakers in different regions. The result of these efforts will be pedagogical materials, children's storybooks, poems, and other literary texts. The team will develop a strategy to take advantage of both print media, which will be used, I think I talked about that, as well as computer networking and so on, which will cater to younger technology-savvy generation and also people living in rural areas in Pakistan especially. The materials to be published will cater to the interests of different people. That was very quick, and that was my proposal, and thank you. Now questions.
One short question.
Oh, my God. Okay. Yes.
If you want to work on the revitalization, will you have to create sort of a standard Burshavsky?
That is a question. There are three dialects, and I don't know which dialect to. I have been in touch with different people, and they have the documentation efforts. Actually, the revitalization efforts that have started with the help of native speakers, native scholars in Pakistan. They have chosen Hunza dialect. But there's the other people in other regions, they don't like that. They are not happy with that, so they are not participating.
Okay.
That is a problem. So that is another major issue, yeah.
Thank you.
Okay.
Our time is up.
Okay. If you have questions, you can ask me outside. Thank you.
I do have a couple questions.
Yes, I will talk to you.